नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Being in a strange place, different energies, impressions rebounding to our consciousness, and then to observe the reactions, the responses, just like when the wind blows and the flowers bend. So I found this brochure, Spiritual Direction, and I thought, that's what we do. The love of God searches for us endlessly. Spiritual direction is a ministry of listening, of trust and support that facilitates insight into questions about the meaning of life, relationships, goals, and aspirations. Are we not trying to understand the meaning of this life and our interactions with each other, with ourselves, with reality or unreality? This ministry, the teaching of the Dhamma and the listening to the teaching of the Dhamma, whether it's in your heart or from someone giving a talk or from reading a book, this ministry is a valuable resource for all who seek to better understand the presence of the divine in their lives. Well, if you change divine to Dhamma, do you see a difference? Divine, Dhamma. We're trying to understand who we truly are. And actually, insight into the Dhamma, the love of the Dhamma begins to grow a certain wisdom in the mind. And the wisdom in the mind grows the love of the Dhamma. And the love of Dhamma is not a personal thing. It's really about growing the quality of love, the quality of opening the heart. So this spiritual direction that we seek, that we begin to gain internally, is purification. Purification of the heart starts with outer action, relationship to others, and internal action, relationship to what is within us. And whatever within us is impure, we have to understand that, know it, and act on it. We must do this so that we're not unaware of our own lack, to act on it in a way that we look inwardly. So whenever we're judging others, it's important for us to see who is judging. How many opinions do we have? How strongly do we feel about other people? Is there anyone that you hate? Just ask, why? Why do we hate other people? I think it's important for us to recognize that hating another person is not understanding what there is to realize about ourselves. Because the quality of hatred in the heart is poison, it's toxic. So if we practice hating, then we're essentially promoting ill will within us. And that's a toxic activity. So even if the society is hating, if we practice hatred, we're killing. It's like we're self-stabbing. And you could say there's no self, but we're stabbing the goodness within us. We're killing it. It's like a destruction of the seeds of goodness. It's like pouring vinegar on a weed. We're not allowed to kill weeds. According to our monastic discipline, we don't kill plants. It's very difficult for us to take care of the gardens in the monastery because the weeds grow and we watch them. Oh, look! Then what's a weed and what isn't? Everything wants to grow. But to weed the mind is much more important than to weed the garden. In fact, the garden of the mind is the most important weeding ground there is. And instead of looking at what other people are doing, we must look at how we're acting towards that. Instead of saying, well, there's a weed, that's a weed, look at what is coming out here. It's a critical mind state, and it just rehearses more critical mind states. We get very expert at pointing out all the weeds in other people. But then it takes us away from looking within us and seeing, can we find compassion for what other people are doing? Instead of calling them weeds, it's just human beings that are suffering a lot, that have a lot of hatred, that are unable to develop their own goodness, and therefore are doing a lot of harm in the world. That is not a cause of happiness. But when we add to that, it's even more toxic, and we self-poison. If we investigate the mind state that expresses ill will, where does that come from? It comes from an opinion about external conditions. And this spiritual work, if we want to direct ourselves well, we must investigate our own state of mind and appropriately put in the causes and conditions for peace and non-conflict, for non-violence within us. It's like expecting the world to disarm. Let's have peace in the world. Let's not fight. But meanwhile, within us, there is this avid critic that is constantly surveying the troublemaking around us, but not looking at how we ourselves provide editorials about that and cling to that. So when we cling to it, we prolong it. When we prolong it, we suffer. When we suffer, we're unhappy. The mind is further disturbed. There is anger, ill will, restlessness, doubt, distraction, and there's no peace. So how do we unravel that? Awareness, mindfulness, and being able to differentiate between being the critic and practicing forgiveness. Forgiveness comes from equanimity about conditions. It comes from having compassion for the ignorance in other beings. What do we lack that we're unable to tolerate the lack in others? Are we lacking? Oh no. It's the ego. It's this sense of self. It's conceit. Not using abusive speech or hateful speech. So to use gentle speech, skillful speech, non-violent speech, opinions are voices. Even if you have silent opinions, they're loud. When we bow, it's a way of erasing our pride. It's a way of giving up the sense of self, of not being, I am this and I am that. It's just bowing. It's letting go any thought of what we are or what we're not as human beings according to any definition. If our body condition increases the amount of pride that we practice, that's not going to help our spiritual development. But in the time of the Buddha, it would be impossible for the men to bow to the women, because in those days, women were just property. And he wanted a tradition that would work, that would be suitable for society, as well as suitable for enlightenment for all beings. We are no less, but neither are we more. What he created was a convention that works, but it's only a convention. It's like a chair. Just the convention itself, a technique itself, is not enlightenment. Like a computer can be used for very evil purposes, and it can also be used to save lives, to develop inventions that will protect humankind from harm. It depends on the mind that uses it. So if we have a mind that is wise and skillful, we know that the convention is only a tool, and we have to use it wisely. The spiritual life is to go beyond conventions, concepts, ideas, to be humble and not to identify with the body. It's to understand intuitively what we truly are. There's this tradition that says this is the God of love. What would the God of love be? It's the highest love? It's the most superior love? It's like the sun that shines on everything, that loves anyone. It doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what you think you are. As human beings, we have within us the seeds of goodness, the seeds of enlightenment, and that's to be remembered. And the God or Godness, that universal quality of love, to be in love. There is still suffering in the world, but the mind would shine towards all forms of being. There would be no superior and inferior, there would just be the witness, the knowing of conditions. That's just the way it is. The truth of the human realm is it's full of suffering, but it's also full of the transcendence of suffering. A joyful appreciation for all forms, the lowly worm and the great benefactor that will go and help strangers. It's our instinct. We have that. It's an instinctive, joyous generosity. In the Metta Sutta, it says, not holding two fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision. We can perceive what we truly are without self. I'm going to get enlightened. There's still a big self there. But we can have a clarity of view about all beings existing as they are in this realm, and receiving all of that equally, and therefore having compassion for all beings. In Christianity, even if at the moment of death you ask for forgiveness, if you trust in Jesus, then you'll be saved. Actually, at the moment of death, if we have enough clarity of view, if Jesus represents enlightenment, the enlightened being or the Godness, the most superior love possible, the God of love, then if one has faith in that, that will save us. What does that mean? If at the moment of death we're able to trust in the mind that is completely clear, just at peace with things exactly as they are, that is a sainthood entry right there. That can save us. The word save is misunderstood. We're rescued from those conditions. There's no more return to birth and death because one is undone. There's no more attachment to being born, to being anything. One transcends that, transcends beyond samsara. So I think that the wording is so different, but what it's pointing us towards is freedom from birth. Belief is mysteriously misleading. Enlightenment doesn't come through belief, but it comes through trust. Trust in the purification of the heart. Trust in the highest form of understanding. Understanding old age. It's the aging of the body. It's not what we are. Understanding suffering. It's the changing conditions of the body, it's not what we are. Understanding the illness which causes us to suffer, and understanding ignorance which causes us to suffer, understanding that there is a way out of that ignorance, and that this path, this way of developing purity of conduct, speech, and the way of seeing, the way of knowing, developing a mind that is still and clear of opinions and judgments, fabrications and attachments to this technique, that technique, this view, that view. Freedom from views is right view. Freedom from fear and freedom from being superior, inferior, being anybody at all is the way to freedom from suffering. Then that's a noble mind. It's a noble heart. A noble mind is fearless. Fearlessness, the noble heart, is a heart of Dhamma. Heart of Dhamma is a heart of pure love. It's unconditional love. Nibbana is unconditional love. It's empty. But emptiness itself doesn't describe it. It's much more than it. But by emptying the mind of whatever there is, we come to a point where there's no one looking. There is just being with awareness, pure, present moment, witness to everything as it is the truth of what we're hungry to know. And we only know that by being here and now, aware, without opinion, without attachment to this tradition, this lineage. Cute story. There was a person standing on a bridge, and someone came along and saw that they were about to jump off the bridge. So they ran up and said, "Don't jump. Don't jump. Please don't jump." "No, I can't. I'm fed up with life. I'm going to kill myself." "No, no, please don't jump. Please don't jump. Are you a Buddhist?" "Yeah." "So am I." "Oh, okay. Well, you know, the Buddha taught that we shouldn't jump. We shouldn't kill ourselves." "Yeah, well, what kind of Buddhist are you?" "I'm a Theravada Buddhist." "Oh, so am I." "Oh, okay. Well, who's your teacher?" "My teacher is so-and-so." "Oh, I don't like your teacher." "Okay, you better jump." It goes on and on. Just, it's all about opinions. Go kill yourself. That's not what the Buddha teaches. The Buddha was so wise, very wise, and he could teach anybody. People would come to him from any walk of life, and he would be able to pour the Dhamma into their hearts, but sometimes they couldn't hear it. And they would just walk away and say, I don't know what you're talking about, because their minds were closed. But if the heart is open and can hear, inevitably when we hear that truth, we feel like we're home. And different ways of presenting the truth appeal to people, and they get it. I've sat with Christian nuns, and at the end of the retreat, we're comparing notes. Hey, I had that same insight as you, but you're a Buddhist and I'm a Christian. Well, yeah, we're doing the same practice. We're eating food, the spiritual food that gives us insight into the truth of what we are. And they discover that we are pure love, and we discover that we are pure love itself. And then we love each other. It's not so simple. To have that kind of love, we have to be willing to sacrifice a lot. We have to give up. In the monastery, we do a lot of giving up. We were telling you about the immigration agent who was so curious. He liked the fact that we were nuns. Buddhist nuns, that's cool. But and he said, why do you shave your heads? And I said, well, so we're not attached to beauty. Well, what's wrong with hair? Letting it just hang down. It's natural. But you got to do something with it. So we just take it off and we don't have to worry about it. It's free. It's very liberating. Not to, the guys have figured it out long ago. It's so freeing. You have to try it. We had to earn a right to shave the head. He got very opinionated about the hair. Attachment. It's not natural. Just what is natural? What is nature? It's not about whether you have hair or not, whether you wear orange or not, whether you wear robes or not, but what do you wear in your heart? Do you shave your heart? Can you get pure inside? Can we not have to wear glasses, but just intuitively know the truth of what we are and live by that, not by what society tells us, not by politics, not by religious affiliation or attachment to a technique, a convention. Mine is better than yours. Again, this is just opinions, and we get lost in it. But where is hospitality? Where is kindness? Where is our precepts? The precepts that we keep are like a net. And you know, if you have a tight net, you know, a tight net is much more useful for catching things than a loose net. I'll give you an example. We have these cedar trees, and we planted them when they were really little. And then the deer came and nibbled on the bottoms. And so then we put fencing around the cedars, and the ones that have fencing are completely full at the bottom, but the ones that didn't have fencing, the deer were so clever. If you put fencing that has big gaps, they stick their noses in and pull out the leaves. But if you have tight nets that are less gaps in them, screens that are tighter weave, so the more rules we have, the more of a screen we have, a filter from the world. The less toxicity we allow to invade our consciousness. And so we live separately from the world, but the world keeps infiltrating, and we have our meditation practice, our Vinaya, our precepts to protect us. And it's really important to have precepts to protect our conduct, speech, even our thoughts, and to behave courteously, even when we don't like what the other one is doing. To watch what's going on in here. Why don't I like it? What's the problem? and to investigate and see where that's coming from. And we do that day in, day out, because we have a limited area in which we live. We don't rely on external fascination or external entertainment to distract us. We're very focused. Our net is small and filtered, and we focus. You focus, and your mindfulness, your wise insight, your ability to know the truth of what you are in your heart and to open to it and stay with it, that's samadhi. When you can stay present for that, it develops slowly, slowly over the years until you don't force it. It's just your nature is to be that way. Then people come in the door and they want to infiltrate. Okay, let's go check them out. We just say, hello, how are you? Can we help you? And then you can tell right away, no, these are thieves. We had that recently. Then we call the police. So we have to be police, but we can do this in a way that gets the thief before they can rob us of our goodness. And so you don't allow other beings to rob you of what you love. You maintain the sanctity of your space, the space within you. And you filter out your friendships, your connections, the people you work for, the company that you choose to work for, how you make your money, what you do with your money. These are decisions that affect the ethics of your whole life. And you have to make big decisions. But at the end of your life, if you don't make those decisions step by step in your life, you'll regret. Oh, I should have. I should have. I wish I had done that. So we develop the wisdom gradually, but we have to begin and sustain that. Using these practices, whichever lineage of practices you choose, let them point towards developing that universal and undifferentiated, convivial, friendly to all beings, loving, compassionate embrace. And trust the Dhamma. These are the conditions that we've been given to work with getting to the unconditioned. What comes up in the heart is just what it is.